Let's cut to the chase. The world of work is changing. There's no stopping that change. Welcome to the Better Work Project, brought to you by the team at SoftEd. I am your host, David Mantica, and joining me as co-host is Andy Cooper. In this podcast, we will explore the changing world of work, what the future of work means, how it affects businesses and workers alike, and how we can create more productive and engaged workplaces. I hope you join us for the ride. Enjoy.
Welcome back to the Better Work Project. We're back with episode 25, and the whole team is here today. I did not get fired. I did get suspended because I was being very bad in the pre-conference preparation, so I was suspended. Is that right, Andy? Was I suspended?
Nah, we were just conned, that's all.
Say hello, Andy. Welcome back from vacation. You were on vacation.
Yeah, I was. I had a great time away in Christchurch mountain biking. It was good fun.
Awesome. That's fantastic, man. No injuries. No injuries, right?
Nope. Good. Just my pride from not being able to do what I wanted.
All right, now we'll go over to LG. LG, how are you? Say hello.
Hi, everyone. It's good to have the band back together.
You were on vacation just recently too, right?
Yeah, I spent Easter.
Yeah, where did you go?
Down in a place called Queenstown. It's a little ski town in the South Island of New Zealand.
Yeah, and so here now, Americans that are listening, you realize that they don't work. None of them ever work. They're always on vacation.
Yeah, we do. We have it pretty lucky that we're allowed vacation.
We can't even come out of our homes without being shot.
Well,
I mean, that's kind of, I don't want to joke about that, but it's getting scarier and scarier here.
Yeah.
So before we jump into Jeremy, and Jeremy is fantastic, we're talking about creating emotionally and cognitively engaged teams, which is a phenomenal topic. And I'm looking forward to this one very, very much. Today, we're going to talk about that and talk about creating more engaged workplaces. We're delighted to introduce Jeremy Dean. Jeremy is the founder of Riders and Elephants, cool name, and his passion is improving relationships, connections, and engagement at work. He's going to talk with us today about unleashing emotions at work, which sounds kind of scary, but let's jump into it.
All right.
LG, it's your game.
Yeah. So, Jeremy, picking up on David's last point, should emotions in the workplace be scary?
They are very scary for the majority of people, I think, is the first place to start. And I'm a big fan of pointing out the elephant in the room. And the elephant is actually, funnily enough, out of my name, Riders and Elephants, the metaphor for emotion. And so it is definitely scary, but it's only scary because they're so misunderstood. And it's like anything in life. If we're uncertain of it, or we're unsure of it, or we have doubts about it, it can become a lot scarier than they are, because they're not. They're a superpower. From my perspective, they're a superpower. And they can have this. They can be small. They can be big. They're not either good or bad. They're just how you think about it. That's a Shakespeare quote, I believe. And they have a disproportionate impact on everything that we do. So they are scary, but they don't have to be. And it's only because they're misunderstood. That's what I've come to learn over the last 6 or 7 years anyway.
Yeah, that's a great start. So let's talk about the emotional culture deck. So you've created this deck as a way to create culture change. Can you talk us through how it came about and what it is?
Yeah, so this whole thing came about sort of by chance and serendipity and accident, if I'm being brutally honest. And what I mean by that is that I, probably 6 or 7 years ago now, I left my job as a consultant at a design company. But we were designing brands and what we call design and culture of organizations, so helping them with their purpose, vision, and value setting, I guess would be the simplest way to put it. And I was becoming a little bit cynical of some of the work we're doing, because time and time again, we were helping HR leaders and CEOs tick their culture box, so to speak, saying we need to reset our values, we need to reset our vision and purpose, and we'll go around the country and we'll make these beautiful posters and we'll tell people how great our culture is. And we were helping them do that really beautifully and designing it really beautifully. But time and time again, I was noticing were very cynical about the process, or questioning why we are doing it again for the 15th time, potentially, if they'd been there in 7 years or whatever it might be. And that was disheartening for me. But about that time, I came across some really fascinating research out of Wharton and George Mason University in the States, which you all might know of. And Sigal Basad is a professor at Wharton, and she wrote this article called Manage Your Emotional Culture. And naturally, that the title of that article piqued my curiosity because I was working in the culture space, but I'd never heard the word emotions put next to the word culture before. Mm. And instantly I was intrigued. And you know how sometimes you read an article, you read even a book, and there's like one paragraph that just stands out and you never forget it. It's just etched in your mind. And this paragraph stood out to me, and it was along the lines of, and I'm paraphrasing a bit now, but it was along the lines of, most companies don't care how their people are feeling or should be feeling at work. They care more about the stated set of values and behaviors. And that really struck me because I'd been spending all of my working life in that space, helping teams to articulate their values and their behaviors, but never having a conversation about emotions in the workplace. Like, that was just a complete no-no, a taboo, a giant waste of time, according to a lot of the people, I imagine, and myself even at the time, to be honest. And so that then took me down this sort of this wormhole of how to have better conversations about the F word or feelings in the workplace and the impact that they have, because emotions, and according to their research of 20 years, like some phenomenal research, how it influences creativity, performance, absenteeism, financial performance of organizations, relationships, connections, all of these things, pretty much anything in the workplace you can think of, emotion will impact at some level. Yet we were only talking about the fancy values posters on the wall. And so that's sort of where the idea of the game came about, and we turned it into a card game. And now the emotional culture deck exists in the world.
Yeah, I think that backstory is so interesting. And I want to pick up your point about ticking culture boxes. David, do you want to jump in here? What do you make of that?
Well, the first thing that hit me was embracing our humanity. I mean, this idea of emotional and cognitive engagement is reaching in and grabbing the power of that, of our humanity, and bringing it into the workplace. And I love the comment about just putting up the token, you know, value sign. And what does it mean to me? I mean, it's just a one-dimensional word, integrity, one-dimensional word, discipline, one-dimensional word, testing. And there's got to be so much more to it. And what I really start worrying about, and Andy might have some cool thoughts on this, is how do you take this emotionally and cognitively engaged concept and spread it out to a bigger, more dispersed organization? I got some thoughts on how you would do it in a small company, having owned my own small company, but the bigger companies where I think it could get quite challenging.
Andy, what are your thoughts?
As David was talking about that, I start sort of coming back to the history of modern management, I suppose, really we're talking about, which, as a lot of you will know, came back to almost 200 years ago now, and the thinking around that and the whole Taylorist philosophy of effectively dehumanizing work and making people into machines. And in a way, you could argue that this is somewhat of a vestige of that era and the thinking that sat behind it, where that was the actual job, was to really dehumanize work and to take out the human aspect. So in a way, what Germany's really doing is actually adding it back. It's like adding back to where what we always had, but it has been taken away for a long time.
And I love that. It got me thinking that I think most organizations are suppressing our humanity, whether they know it or not. But I feel as if my job, and it's my responsibility now and all of our responsibility, but I create some games to help nudge us, is that how we embrace it more.
So how do you stop people from thinking humanity so ugly? I mean, I get, Andy, everything you're saying is right on target, right? The humanity is what blocks the production. I can't measure it. I can't monitor it. It stops the line from producing. So let's block it out. But how do we start pushing aside? And what are you guys doing, Riders and Elephants, Jeremy, to start really trying to tell people that humanity can be quite beautiful and productive and efficient and make you successful?
Well, it's a stem of creativity. There's so many positive attributes that come from this, from people being able to express feelings. So in a way, it's the reverse of perhaps people's common thinking, in that I think we're actually victims now of that sort of old way of thinking. And especially if we look forward, where machines will replace what were the mechanistic type of jobs, and what is left, jobs that require human characteristics. So we need to add back in the feelings, which is actually a core attribute of being human.
So Jeremy, let's kind of jump back into what you've created. And we know that we spend a solid chunk of time at work, and we know that connection is really important for work. how does your experience and your emotional culture deck help to begin to reform those connections and for us to be better connected with our teams?
Can I really break the rules here and just go back two steps? Because yeah. I had one thing I just wanted to add on that, which I really, really love.
Go for it, brother. Go for it.
Yeah. And because there was a small question that says, how do we, because of the doom and the gloom that exists potentially in the worlds that we're living in and the environments we're in, how do we get people to see that there's a different way? Mm-hmm. And I think from my perspective, it's we fear what we don't know. And so we have to familiarize ourselves and people to it. And the more familiar we become with it, the easier it becomes. And I create games. I like to call myself a game maker. Mm. And games are a really low barrier Trojan horse to helping familiarize people with concepts that they might normally be unfamiliar with or normally be scared or afraid of. And so the more we can familiarize people with emotion or feeling, specifically in the workplace, the more over time it becomes normalized. Mm. And the more normal it is, the more we can embrace it and use it to change. And so I think the familiarity, the more we can nudge people to become familiar with it through games because they're low barriers, the more interesting it, the easier it becomes. Yeah. So I think that was a really great question.
Do you also think that people have quite a low level vocabulary when it comes to emotion? We often think in terms of mad, sad, glad. We don't really label emotions appropriately. How do we, once we've got that familiarity, how do we build on it?
Well, yeah, I'm so excited that you mentioned that because my number one insight over the last 6 or 7 years in the world that I'm in with these games is that people want to talk about this, they just don't know how. We don't have the labels, we don't have the vocabulary, we have the good, okay. How often have you asked even a friend or a coworker how are you feeling and you get good or okay or not great, potentially not great, that's a really deep response. We don't have the labels, and because we don't have the labels, we can't articulate it and then we can't connect. And I think that comes to your question around how do we better connect. We can't connect with each other unless we have a mechanism to do that. And language is a really, really powerful mechanism which has existed since we've discovered language, I guess. Yeah. And the unfortunate thing is this is not a leadership problem. It's not an organizational problem. It's a systemic societal and cultural thing, is that we don't teach people, especially young people, how to talk about their emotions. We don't give them the labels, which means that we then try to desperately teach people in their later years these concepts. And then often by then we've missed out on so much opportunity to connect with others, build relationships, that sometimes it's almost a little bit too little too late. Although actually I don't subscribe to that, because I think you can start. I started on this journey only 6 years ago. Mm. So you can start any time, but we need to help people develop the labels, and it's especially important at a younger age, I think.
It's kind of interesting how you were saying before, just asking someone a really basic question of how they are. It's so programmed these days. How are you? I'm fine. I'm good. And then sometimes asking the question again, in how are you really doing, unravels like a completely different story. But there's that programming. Andy, do you want to jump in? What are your thoughts on building and maintaining connection?
It was just interesting, just building on what Jeremy was saying, because that whole language of how am I feeling is actually, I think, gaining a lot of prominence, obviously, outside of the emotional culture deck. I know there's quite a lot of work going on in the US in schools. So that's the good, encouraging thing now, that there are trials going on with using, and I can't remember the person's name, but it's a Stanford professor or something. They've basically set up a foundation where the goal is to help effectively people to better label their feelings. And in fact, there's an app you can download called Mood Meter, which I've used for a while, which is quite good at actually using. It has like a quadrant. I mean, out of that, it plots a pretty accurate definition of your sort of mood. And from that, it has suggestions of how to improve things if you're in a low space. So I think there's definitely work going on internationally, and also for young people. They've seen very clear evidence that it really does help young people. You know, obviously, they'll benefit as adults as well in being able to label how they feel. So that's the good news, I think, is that it's the awareness is growing and it's starting to trickle down into the start point, the school area. I don't know if that's happening in New Zealand yet, but certainly I have heard about it in America.
Yeah, Dr. Mark Brackett. So he's the head of emotional intelligence for Yale. And his book is called Permission to Feel. And it's one of my top three books of all time. It is the most phenomenal book. I only came across it 18 months ago as well, which makes me a little bit disheartened because I wish I'd come across it a long, long time ago. But Dr. Mark Brackett specifically, he's the fellow who created the mood meter, and his work is simply phenomenal.
Well, there you go. So I'm glad that you were able to pick up the detail that I had forgotten, but I knew it was, you know, all I had was the app and the reading around it, and know that he has created quite a movement in the US, which I think is all starting to permeate other places as well. And I know the research and findings from that are pretty clear and profound. Mm.
There's an interesting podcast that actually Mark Brackett features on, if you want to early introduction into this. It's with Brené Brown. It's called Permission to Feel. So check that out. Be quite interesting. And I want to jump to David. What are your thoughts here?
Oh man, all over the place as I'm listening. And I'm going to break it down to a couple things. The first thing I'd love to hear from Jeremy on after I finish pontificating would be, how did he work on the language in the card deck? How did you break down the language? And did you break it down into specific words, or did you break it down into phrases? And what you're saying is so right, because for me, I'm really interested in the word love. And to me, the word love has been bastardized because it's always tied back to the intimacy love aspect. And the Greeks had the four words for love. And the other piece of this is sometimes we don't feel like loving, but we can still do the act of loving. And the Greeks have a word for that as well, which is I'm just still going to do because it's the right thing to do, even though I don't feel that way. So I do think that language issue that you talk about is so critically important. So give me your thoughts. How did you tackle that?
Yeah, there's a couple of really amazing things there. First, the conversation about love there is really fascinating for me, because I didn't know a thing called companionate love existed. But Sigal Basad, who's the researcher and the professor behind emotional culture, the concept, has also done a whole bunch of research into companionate love in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of love in the workplace.
Yeah. So that's the misunderstanding again, not having the right label or the understanding of companionate love or love itself, the different, how you define love, how that then becomes a barrier to, or creates disconnect rather than connection itself. But in terms of the language on our cards, we don't have phrases. The labels are either emotions, feelings, or what could be considered a feeling state, I guess. I haven't strictly just put emotion labels in our game. There are some things that are considered feelings and some things that could be considered a feeling state, and they're just singular labels. And when I designed this game, I designed it for teams and leadership teams originally. And so the words I ended up putting into the game were more associated with the culture of teams, I think, would probably be the way of putting it, rather than personal or individual emotion and emotion drivers. So there's a slight variation between Mark Brackett's work and our work, which I think actually I use them together, funnily enough. But I've gone for singular words and no definitions. I haven't defined the words or the labels in our game because I come from a design background and working with design in a design agency for a long time, I'm really interested in how different people define what those words mean to them. Because in our game, for instance, we have the word courageous and brave, which could be considered a synonym. But I'm interested, let's say, Lauren, you pick out the word, you want to feel brave in your work, or to feel successful, you need to feel brave. And I say, to feel successful, I need to feel courageous. We could potentially pick two different labels, but then talk about that in the same way. Or we might pick the same label and talk about it in a different way. And as a designer, as an experienced designer, that's interesting for me because that gives us insight into how we then take that and then manifest it in the language we use inside our workplace or how we create rituals. There are a lot of synonyms in our pack for the reason that I want to understand what label somebody's drawn to over another one.
Is that also the point of the deck, to prompt the better conversation so that we can then have an explainer around what that word means to that person and then how that person can connect to their team? So talk to me about that.
Yeah, so you could go far deeper because you talk about what feeling courageous means to you and I talk about what feeling brave means to me, and they might be the same or they might be different, but all of a sudden we're creating a connection because we're learning from each other about each other. At the same time, there's a self-awareness piece to that because I'm reflecting myself on why feeling brave. Brave is actually one of the top three things I want to feel in my work, and I get a chance to reflect on why feeling brave is important to me, how that's going to help me be successful. And then I also learned from you how, hypothetically, if courageous was one of your ones, why courageous is important to your success. and we share stories and we completely flip the conversation in the workplace, going from we want you to do this or why aren't you doing this or what are you doing to what are the emotions driving your behavior and that lead to your success.
Now, David, I know you've got a really strong viewpoint that we don't have crucial workplace conversations, that we need to. What do you want to add to that?
There's just so much to add because, you know, what you're doing, Jeremy, is so powerful and it could be taken in so many great directions. It's the idea of we have so many problems in this country, in the U.S., because we like people we like, yet we're not able to articulate the emotion to say why we don't like something because you're just not supposed to like something. Whereas if I can articulate the emotion of not liking something, then I can communicate that. Maybe somebody can help me understand and see that my not like isn't because I don't like it. It's because I don't understand it or know it. And I know that sounded like some babble, but the concept here is it's through that explaining process that you can really get in touch with someone and learn about them. It's because humanity is threefold, that means humanity's got a spiritual element to it that it just doesn't get tapped into the basic language that we have. And the only way you can tap into that is through having deeper conversations and maybe then connecting on some type of electrical level. I'd probably get a little too airy-fairy. But to me and the company I own, that was the most critical factor. The moment I stepped away from the product and into the people and started seeing people for their strength and just wanted to connect with those folks and watching when I connected with someone and they shared how much they were willing just to do whatever they had to do. And it became, even when it was tough, it was fun. That power was amazing. The problem is, how do you scale it? How do you get people to believe that that's just not overhead? Anyways, that's a lot of babble, but yeah, I certainly believe in a lot of, in all of what Jeremy is talking about.
Jeremy, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, it's really powerful. I think the thing that comes to mind there for me is that, especially around unpleasant emotions or undesired emotions, however which way people like to refer to them, is that there's a strange thing that happens when we label our unpleasant emotions or the things that we don't like, potentially. We just don't have we don't label them as emotions, is that when you have to name it to tame it. And the interesting thing at a neurochemical level for those sort of science nuffies or people curious like me is that when we label unpleasant emotions, we actually reduce the unpleasantness of that experience because it goes from our limbic system to our prefrontal cortex. And I think that makes this really, really profound and powerful. So when we're talking about the things that we don't like, if we can understand the unpleasant emotional drivers and then label them, coming back to this labeling, that reduces the unpleasantness, which then will allow us to connect better with the person that we're potentially in conflict with or not in conflict with. So it becomes incredibly profound and powerful to give people the language and the labels to have these conversations. But one thing that's holding us back, if we think about the scaling question there, I don't necessarily like to think so much about scale because I don't think we can think about scale until we figure out how to make it work at a really micro level. And at a micro level, the one thing holding everybody, organizations, teams, society back from having these conversations is the emotional discomfort that leaders have themselves. And I often come across leaders who say, we can't talk about this. There's no ROI. It doesn't matter. It's a waste of time because we've got to focus on something else. And more often than not, my assumption, hypothesis, is that comes down to their own emotional discomfort having these conversations, which then means that we don't, as a leader, we're not open to allowing other people to have these really profound and important conversations. And it loops back to our own discomfort as a leader. And so overcoming the emotional discomfort of leaders is almost the most micro thing we need to begin with. So then we can help it proliferate out into the rest of the system and community and network.
And have you seen from your experience how that's done well or any insight into that? How do we do that better?
After 6 or 7 years of using this game with thousands and thousands of people, you could imagine I've come across every type of leader on the spectrum of this. They intuitively understand it and believe what I believe and get this conversation to conversations with leaders. And I'm not sure about what sort of language we can use on this podcast, but comments like, I don't care how my people are feeling. I just want them to do their effing job.
Oh, wow.
Or I don't have emotions, mate. All I feel is apathy and contempt for the world.
Oh, that's very cynical.
And so the cynicism that exists there is real and understandable, and I can empathize with that. But at the same time, my response that it exists because of the own discomfort of having those conversations. Mm. And I've seen, and this is now related to my game, which I'm the most experienced at in terms of my life, because I do it all day, every day, is that there's a shift, and I see this time and time again. And I call it a shift or a little aha moment where a leader will pick up cards. They could be our cards or any cards that have emotions on them as well, by the way. But they pick up the cards with the labels on it, and then you see them flicking through those cards and pulling out the things that they want to feel, and then they want their teams to feel, and having a conversation about something they said 20 minutes ago that didn't effing matter or they don't even have.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
And those moments are really special to me.
They've changed their opinion and seeing what it means to their teams as well.
Oh, hugely so. Hugely so. I've also seen it not change. Equally so. The work I'm doing is not a silver bullet. This game is not a silver bullet, but it nudges people to overcome their initial resistance, which is caused because of the inability to say, I can't talk about this because I don't know how. Because very few people, unfortunately, are willing to put their hand up and say, I don't know something. And I can, and for good reasons, from status and certainty in our systems and our communities. But once we give people the ability to do it, then all of a sudden it shifts. There's a shift and it unleashes a new mindset. And I don't think it's a great idea to tell people how they should think differently or tell people that their beliefs are wrong, because ultimately you can't change people's belief with science or evidence. There's a really cool thing called the backfire effect. Have any of you come across the backfire effect?
No, tell us about it.
The backfire effect is this concept that if you hold a different belief to me, so if you're a flat earther and I'm a round earther, is that what you call somebody who believes the world's round, a round earther? If I believe the world is round and you believe it's flat, if I present you with evidence, facts and evidence to prove your flat earth belief wrong, it only reinforces your belief even further. Mm. So it backfires. And I think the same is true with our game and emotions in the workplace. If we present evidence and research to people about why this matters, it just reinforces their beliefs that it doesn't matter even further. But if we give somebody a game or the mechanism or a tool that can help shift their beliefs themselves from an experience, that's really powerful. And so I don't spend a lot of time talking about the research to begin with when I meet people, because I find it can really quickly put barriers up. And I just get into playing the game and then let people experience the shift themselves and then explore possibilities with them.
That's a confirmation bias example. The brain does not process something I don't believe in. Mm-hmm. And what you have to do then is you build the relationship, and you build the relationship. Most of the time, the person would just walk away and they wouldn't have a relationship. But if you truly change someone, you build a relationship with them on some type of commonality. And at some point in time, they connect with you. And as they connect with you, they start having shared experiences, which then can alter their perspective. It's, I always say, you can't change somebody else. You can only change the way in which you interact with them. And that was a great example showing that. And I think this type of tool helps people to try to engage with someone on difficult topics and not lose their belief in the humanity of that other person. That's the problem. The problem is, the moment we don't agree with somebody, we believe they're not human anymore. They're subhuman. They're dumb. They're useless. They're not worth engaging. And certainly on this countryside, we see a lot of that, and it's festered over the last 4 years.
Yeah, that's such a powerful quote. You can't change someone else. You can only change the way you engage with them. And that is that's at the heart of everything that I make and build and design. Is I'm hoping that we can change these games, these types of games, and other games out there, which I love, change the way that we engage with other people. And that flips the conversation. The conversation then flips a team, and the team then flips the culture.
Jeremy, I want to pick up on the connection part, and I'm kind of curious how that's changed with remote work. How are you seeing that shift impacting engagement and the way that we're connecting with others?
So, yeah, obviously we are still going through, in various parts of the world, some pretty peculiar times when it comes to how we're now working because of the disconnect or the remote aspect of working. And I've heard stories that either end of the spectrum as well, where some workplaces it's actually improved the way they connect, and other workplaces it's made it even more challenging and even more difficult and hasn't worked out. And for me, that's interesting in itself, because it's not a blanket remote work has made work more difficult or more challenging for people, there's so many variations between it. And then I start to look at what are the commonalities or the threads. And I thought, so far, from the stories I've heard around how it's had a positive influence, so working remotely has been good, is because for better or worse, often these new open plan workplaces, I've found anyway, have actually created less collaboration and created more mental barriers between people, even though the space is physically open. And Adam Grant has talked about some really fascinating research on this. It's how open plan offices reduce collaboration and communication, which is the irony of it, right? Because we tore down the walls to create more collaboration and more communication, yet the opposite of that is happening across the world. And for me, what I've seen with the companies that have thrived in remote work who've come from an open plan office has meant that actually they've been far more deliberate and created more moments to actually connect with people that they weren't doing in their open plan offices when they're working face to face. And so actually those companies have harnessed that and created ways to be better connected, because previously in an open plan office they weren't. And I was like, wow, that's fascinating. Like, I'm hearing these stories from leaders. And then I think on the flip side, where it's been more challenging, is that the incidental connections that you have in the office working physically have been eviscerated. You don't have that because you're not bumping into people. You're not overhearing stuff. And the companies that have thrived despite missing that are the ones who figured out a way to create micro connections between people, even though they're not face-to-face or they're not bumping into each other. So it's both ends of the spectrum. It has helped some and it has hindered others. But I think the final thing that I've noticed is the ones that have thrived during it are the ones who've been really deliberate about creating new rituals. So not just doing what everybody used to do when we were face-to-face, not applying the same things and then just figuring out how it works or reapplying the same thing, copy and pasting it to the remote world, is actually redesigning and creating new rituals, new moments to connect and new ways to do that, rather than just going, we did it that way when we were face-to-face, so let's just do it that way now remotely. So those leaders are the ones I think have had the most success.
Has that also been the case when thinking about customers? Because I know we've talked a little bit about internal teams, but your team has also produced a customer experience deck. So I'm curious how we can use that to create better connections with our customers as well.
Yeah, great question. I haven't necessarily been considering the impact of remote work on customers so far in my work, just because I'm so obsessed with the emotional culture deck world. But the game itself, even not necessarily the game, the customer experience deck, but the core question at the heart of it is so applicable to the times that we're in right now. And I guess just quickly to give people context or background, the reason why I designed the customer experience deck was because most customer conversations inside teams or organizations start with either what do we want the customer to do or what can the customer do for us? So a very functional or rational conversation. What are the behaviors once again? And I always wondered, I thought we were missing a trick because emotion drives human behavior. So why instead don't we ask, how do we want our customers to feel when they engage with us? And how do we not want them to feel when they engage with us? And then based on a shared perspective or a shared understanding as a team on the five things we want our customers to feel and the five things we don't want our customers to feel, now how do we create experiences to help elicit the pleasant emotions and help our customers either avoid or manage the unpleasant ones? And so for the particular times we're in right now, it's really powerful because you could change the conversation to say, how do we want our customers to feel during this pandemic? And then you have a conversation that's specific to the moment we're in right now and look at the difference between what it was usually versus what it is now in the current environment.
Andy, I know this is something you've got a keen interest in. Do you want to jump in with your thoughts here?
Well, it's been a really fascinating discussion, so I've really enjoyed listening to it. So thanks, everyone. A couple of things, the remote working. So absolutely my understanding and just of the research that's coming out and just our experience of the remote working is very similar to what Jeremy was describing as well, that the organizations that have deliberately, figured out how to work in that environment are thriving. Those that have just tried to recreate the rituals from the past is where I think a lot of burnout and a lot of issues are happening. I mean, just to give you the context, I heard a stat that sort of blew me away a couple of weeks ago, which was something like in was it maybe 2 months ago, there was like in the US, like 5% of employees turned over. And that's a massive amount of turnover. And apparently that trend is continuing. So this whole experience has not worked well for people. And when they have choice, it's going to be interesting to see how that impacts on people's loyalty and how they stick around. So that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in over time. But in terms of customers, I think if I think about it from a personal perspective, then I think what I've learned, and I think this whole language where it's helped, is to really try and create a real deep human connection with the people that I work with. It will often start with, how do you feel? How are you feeling about things as well? In the context that we're in a pandemic and things are not normal. And you can just tell that creates a different type of relationship and feels a lot better. And again, I can sort of thank Jeremy's work for helping normalize this sort of to into our customer relationships. And I mean, obviously now in the world of design, the empathy maps and those sort of things are really pretty cool tools to help you try and get into the minds and the feelings of people as well. So I think this is the start of bringing this language into the customer world as well.
Yeah, and it's really great to see the shift, I think, happen. Before we wrap up, I want to jump into the quick fire round. So I'm looking for a quick soundbite from each of you. Let's start with you, Jeremy. The secret to more human-centered workplaces is?
The F word.
I love that.
Feelings. Yeah, feelings for those of you who are wondering.
David? The secret to more human-centered workplaces is?
Willingness to put yourself in somebody else's shoes.
And Andy, same question.
Yeah, similar, but I just say human-centered leaders to start this.
Yeah, good. That leads to the next question. As a leader, I can prioritize connection by? Jeremy?
Expressing my vulnerabilities.
David?
Taking time to speak, not about work, but about life with each person you're connected with.
And Andy?
Yep, all of that. But in at least weekly, meaningful one-on-one discussions with my team.
And Jeremy, workplaces need to be more something and less something else.
This is a really good question. These quickfire ones didn't. I wasn't as quick as answering them when I was considering them. I think workplaces need to be more experimental and less narcissistic.
Oh, great answer. Great answer.
I love that
Andy,
word.
Andy or David,
word.
Can you...
No, Andy first, brother.
Okay, so it's not one word. I'm sorry, but I couldn't quite manage that. Yeah. But I think more fun, purposeful, and challenging. Mm-hmm. That's from learning and arguments and work, yes. And less about time spent working and superficial relationships and boring work.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, and David,
workplaces need to be more. Wow, it's a tough one. I should have prepared better. Workplaces need to be more open, and they need to be less bureaucratic, less territorial.
Yeah, I can get on board with that. Jeremy, in 10 years' time, the biggest change you want to see at work is?
More young people in leadership positions.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. I like it.
Did that hurt, David?
Yeah, it's all far to be a kick to the curb. I love it. Well, you're as old as me. You can't get my job because you're too old.
Notice I didn't say less old people in leadership positions, though.
David.
What did you say, young fellow?
You whippersnapper.
You whippersnapper.
Andy, David.
Andy first.
So what I want to see is a four-day work week, learn to earn and yearn to learn.
Oh,
wow. I don't really want to add to that. That was pretty darn good.
Should have gone first.
No, I love it.
Okay. We'll wrap up with that.
We'll end on that. That is awesome.
Let's end there. That was episode 25 of the Better Work Project. We want to thank Jeremy for making time to speak with us and for talking about a topic that's important for everyone, no matter your role. If you're interested in learning more about the Riders and Elephants team, you can check out their incredible culture prompts and products at ridersandelephants.com. And from the Better Work Project team, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on this edition of the Better Work Project. If you like this episode, please be sure to rate, review, and tell your friends and colleagues about it. If you have specific suggestions or ideas for future podcasts, please do not hesitate to reach out to us. Continue to fight the good fight. We'll see you the next time on the Better Work Project. Thank you.